something else to explain how he came to be here. How did he get here from Israel? You know, from Palestine, we talk about. Understand that? How did he get here? And Pauline, his romance, his original romance, was a piece of fiction, never offered as anything else by him. It was poorly written, so Book of Mormon is so poorly written, it's loudly offered. But the idea of it was that it was to be an explanation of two things, among others, the two basic things, and that is how the American Indian got here and how the Israelites got to the New World and where the mounds came from. And so, and this, if you recognize this in the Book of Mormon, it's supposed to be that kind of story. That's one of the reasons why it's completely, the basic historical framework was written as fiction. This is why there's no connection between history and the Book of Mormon. It's never written as history. They look at it, they locate places if it's written as fiction.
If y'all see this question,
so, this lost theory. Now, technically speaking, the Book of Mormon does not say that the American Indians are the lost 10 tribes of Israel, so that they're a lost Israelite, you see. It's a version of that. But it came from this second Esther, you got that originally, which was believed to be Bible in the Middle Ages. And the favorite game was, where's Israel, Israel, where is Israel? Among those, besides us, the American Eskimos have been Israel. And, it's hard to find people who haven't been Israel. That is, to find those who have been. Well, now, we're going to come, so the Book of Mormon, as it fits into this, as it is outlined, let me just give you the brief outline of the Book of Mormon. Some of this I'm going to give you later, okay? My equipment broke down, as I said. So I'm going to give you an outline of the Book of Mormon. What I'm going to give you now, you're going to have a copy of it. So don't panic. The Book of Mormon is not a wicked book, morally. It is not a copy of the King James, although Spaulding, when he wrote it, if I'm right about the Spaulding manuscript theory, Spaulding, when he wrote it, tried to make it sound ancient, because it was supposed to represent an ancient time. But he didn't know anything about languages or ancient times, so the only ancient language he knew was King James English, and so he cast in King Jamesian kind of language. And it sounds like that. It sets a high moral standard. It's best described as an epic novel. Interestingly enough, the Book of Mormon, you see, the doctrine of polygamous marriages and all that stuff came late to Joseph Smith. He developed that to justify his philandering. The Book of Mormon came early, which explains why the Book of Mormon is monotheistic. The Book of Mormon itself destroys utterly the Mormon doctrine of God. The Book of Mormon makes it very clear there's one God, not many. Are you with me? The Book of Mormon destroys the Mormon doctrine of God just as much as the Bible does. It is monotheistic. Because it came early. That's very embarrassing to the Mormons. By the way, the Mormons don't use the Book of Mormon very much. They use the other books more. The Mormon trilogy, if you're interested, is the Book of Mormon, the Doctrines and Covenants, D&C they call it, and the Pearl of Great Price. That's the Mormon trilogy, the sources of Revelation. As the story goes, about 600 B.C. in Jerusalem, back in the days roughly of Jeremiah and Isaiah, same general time period, there was a prophet called Lehi, and I'm going to give this to you so you don't take notes if you don't want to, of the tribe of Manasseh, who warns people the way the other prophets were. And like, remember Jeremiah was run out of the country? So he was run out. And Lehi, he goes to the Arabian Peninsula with his wife, Sariah, his sons, Laman, Lemuel, and Sam. I love that. Now, he has, and also the most important son that he has is Nephi, son of Lehi. And there they're joined by a fellow called Zoam and another man called Ishmael, and unfortunately just has a bunch of daughters to provide wives for the sons of Lehi, and they get it on. They get married. And God commands them to build some boats, which come out something halfway between submarines and fishing bobbers, as they're described. And they get their seal in these boats, and they go across the Pacific and land on the west coast of the Americas. where they find horses before they were there, and elephants were never there, and yeah, right. On the way, they read the Bible, had to do something during the long voyage, and they read, and this comes, it gets recorded in the Book of Mormon, they read chapters of Isaiah, in fact, there's 13 chapters of Isaiah from the King James that just copied into the Book of Mormon in this period. And they make many exciting predictions, including, keep in mind, this is around 600 B.C., details about the ministry of Christ. As a matter of fact, they explain some of the very complicated doctrines of Jesus before 600 years before he even gave them. They were very good seers. Well, they get to the New World, and everything goes along fine until the old battle between good and evil develops. The righteous Nephi, it's his descendants, the Nephites, get in the battle with the not-so-righteous Lamanites, and this is the primary plot of the book. The Lehites against the Lamanites, the good guys against the bad guys. The bad guys win out, and God, to punish them, turns their skin dark. That's why the American Indian is kind of dark Israelite. And the last Nephite alive in this, after a series of battles, is Moroni, who later visits Joe Smith, about 1,400 years later, this took place around 420 A.D., the final battle, after several centuries, and Moroni was the last of the Nephites to live. He buried the books of the Nephites, the golden plates, and then he died, and that's the end of the Book of Mormon. And then in the early 1800s, he visits Joseph Smith and shows as an angel. Only Moroni comes back as an angel and shows Joseph Smith where these plates are. Funny story. And Mormonism is born. That's the theory. That's a little too fast on that. That's just kind of a rough overview of what the Book of Mormon is. A lot of people don't have any idea what the Book of Mormon is about. That's the story of the Book of Mormon. Yes. After they were translated, an angel took them back to heaven. However, they were seen by witnesses. Bella called Harris, Cowdery, and Whitmer. They testified that they saw the plate. Later on, by the way, Cowdery was a blacksmith. You don't know if he made plates or not. All three of these men later were kicked out of the church and then let back in, a couple of them. Harris later explained he saw them with the eyes of faith, didn't actually see them, exactly. Then there were eight other witnesses who saw them. Three were members of the Smith family, four were members of the Whitmer family, or the three witnesses, and one had married a Whitmer daughter, that made eight. Mark Twain said of this, "I could not feel more satisfied and at rest if the entire Whitmer family had testified." I love that. That is a brief outline of the Book of Mormon. Let me give you, keep in mind the Mormon Trilogy, the Book of Mormon, Pearl of Great Price, Doctrines and Covenants. Actually, most of the basic doctrines are in the latter two, not the Book of Mormon. The Book of Mormon, the Mormons could get along pretty well without it. It is not their, the as far as the construction of their theology, it is not the most important book, the other two. Now, very briefly now, let me give you I'll not give you an outline of this. I'll just go over this with you. And I'm not going to hold you responsible on an exam for this stuff. But let me just give you briefly the next 10 minutes, more, maybe 15 minutes, an outline of Mormon history. And again, this is very sketchy. Understand in a course like we could take the whole quarter, we could just study Mormonism. Understand we have to, through the movie of what I'm giving you, I hope you get the general idea. But that's all we can do for any of these cults. I accepted the Spalding manuscript thesis. I think Charles Shook did the research and established it. And also, I just simply think that Joseph Smith was not capable of it. Now, you may have been. I would not sit up all night and defend the Spalding theory. That's how I accept it. If Joseph Smith did it, I think it's possible because there's no question in my mind, and the movie suggests this very strongly, that Joseph Smith was demon possessed. He has an occult background, and Mormon is one of those cults that overlaps heavily with the occult. he bore all the marks of demon possession, or many of the marks of demon possession, which are the crystal gazing and that kind of thing. His mother was a soothsayer. She was an occultist. He was raised in an occult home. And this is the source of most demon possession begins with the occult. And obsession with death and obsessions with sex, obsession with suicide, these are characteristics of demon possession or heavy demon influence. And great cruelty. And it's very possible that Joseph Smith did write it under the influence of the demon. I'm not trying to be spooky about this, but I think that's possible. That's possible. Now, but anyway, just for what it's worth, in 1813 and 1814, Sidney Rigdon, who was a kind of useless young fellow, the gift of gab, not empty brain, gift of gab, he's hanging around a print shop. A friend of his works for a print shop in Pittsburgh. And this is the connection, by the way. He's got a good friend who works for a print shop in Pittsburgh, and Sidney Rigdon hangs around with him. And while he's there, this print shop is printing the Spalding manuscript. Called Manuscript Found, I think it was one manuscript or all the manuscripts. And he's printing this fiction, this novel written by Spalding, who's a congregational minister in poor health, who wrote the letter. In 1815, the Smiths moved to Palmyra, New York, which was called the Burgover District. By the way, this area, several major cults and some minor cults began. It was like, well, the devil owned that piece of real estate. Where Christian Science began, and Shakerism, and took root, and several other cults. Seventh-day Adventism was born there, and you can trace the Jehovah's Witnesses back to there, because they trace back to Miller. So, all several cults, and I'm convinced the devil has staked off lots in that area, in that general area where Smith came from. Historians call the Burgover District because one religion after another came through and made fools of people. It's like as soon as one religion created hysteria, another one would come in. Now this is something. You understand the Christian Science, Jehovah's Witness, instead of the Adventism, were born, the Shakerism took root in America and in England. Okay, now, in 1820, Smith, as he tells it later, is praying in the woods. This is one of the versions. He never could remember what he said. You know, when you're lying, you've got to keep your story straight. He couldn't do it. And two people they appeared to him, told him all religions are false. He told it later. In 1821, Rigdon meets Alexander Campbell. In 1823, Smith is digging for lost treasure, looking. He put this, stone he found, put it in a hat. He would put it in a hat, and then he would put his face into the hat in the dark, and then the stone would give him visions. In one of his accounts, he said, this is how he translated the golden plates. Put the golden plates over here, put the stone in his hat, put his face in the hat, and read the golden plates. Well, that didn't make much sense, because you need the golden plates, you weren't even looking at them. So then later, he changed the story that the angel gave him an Urim and a Thummim. Nobody knows what the Urim and the Thummim are. Something had to do with the breastplate of the high priest. But he told it there were two huge spectacles. Like there was a big one looked through one eyeglass. And he looked through these special lenses of the Urim and the Thummim. That's how he translated the golden plate. And then the angel took them back to heaven. Got the golden plate that he broke. And of course, what he was doing, one of the reasons, in the original edition, the Book of Mormon came out with terrible grammar. They had to clean it up. So Joseph Smith, Rigdon had Spalding, he was using what he had. Paris was on one side. What Smith did was under the curtain up in his cabin. He was behind the curtain with the golden plate, nobody else could see. And then Harris, originally, and another fellow later, they did the writing as he read over the blanket. Now, the problem was that he wasn't educated. And his grammar was terrible. He wouldn't even read what somebody else wrote. And this is Harris. Her husband was being made a fool of. And so she asked to see her husband to bring home 18 pages of the manuscript after it was copied. What happened was that Smith, as I reconstructed, it's hard to tell because you have been to be working with. He got to reading this and copying by hand. We got one ignorant man who's barely to bring it to another, very laborious. So eventually he just started shifting page of the manuscript, understand, using page of the original manuscript somehow, using without even bothering copying it, for some sections anyway. And Mrs. Harris, she stole 18 pages of the manuscript. And the priest actually went to show them to somebody, and she burned them. And her husband really got on. He's a much more problem, actually. It's a divine revelation to have God was revealed again. Except that she said that Smith didn't notice whether Mrs. Harris was burned. She didn't tell him. She didn't tell him until later she had burned him. She said she lost him. He was afraid that she'd come up with something, and then she'd produce the pages were shown to be a liar, so he got a vision from the Lord that those pages weren't important. Somebody might try to hook you up the originals and put some of on the ballot. Later on, Rigdon kind of filled in from his memory, kind of filled in what those pages were until they probably got problem. Anyway, 1825, Rigdon is leaning toward the restoration movement of the Campbells and the Scotts and the Stone, or the Campbells mainly, that area. And he's working on the Spalding manuscript, I think. 1826, Rigdon joins the Stone Campbell movement, and during that year, Harrison Smith and some others have a little club called the Golden Bible Company. And they get together and have secret meetings. In 1827, Rigdon begins preaching Mormon doctrines. Interesting. This is one of the reasons why Rigdon, who had access to the Spalding manuscript, Rigdon started preaching Mormonism before Joe Smith did. Sidney Rigdon, who traveled with Alexander Campbell, and Campbell rode his horse from Pennsylvania to Kentucky for their walk to debate the Presbyterian Metallic. Sidney Rigdon rode with him. Rigdon was a few months after that, was preaching Mormon doctrines before Joe Smith. In fact, I'm of the opinion that Stone will get into that, so he's going to have a church of his own. Found his manuscript, and he's going to have his own movement. But the problem is that he took Joe Smith into it, and the problem was that Rigdon was an amateur con man, and Joe was a professional. In fact, he'd been in jail for it. And Joe took Sidney, and Sidney never knew what hit him. That is, Joe worked it out that he became the top dog. And I'm convinced that Sidney Rigdon was all along planned to be the leader of this new group. Now, I can't prove that, but it sure makes sense in light of all that happened. But the Book of Mormon comes from the press in 1830. The first Mormon church in Manchester, which is in Manchester, New York, is organized that year. By the way, what they call it when first was established? Well, the Church of Christ. The Mormon church was called the Church of Christ for its first 4 years through the influence of Sidney Rigdon. Like, I've even had Mormon elders come to me saying, we're from the Church of Christ. They use that term today, son. Now, in 1831, by the way, Smith, in 1830, assumes the title Senior Translator, Prophet, Apostle of Jesus Christ, Elder of the Church, to the will of God, the Father, and the grace of your Lord Jesus Christ. He's it. He declares himself the leader, the apostle, the prophet. Rigdon is a matter in a wet hand. Now, They can't get the movement established in New York because everybody knows them. And so they move to the frontier, Kirtland, Ohio, which is up near Cleveland. Build a temple. It's still there, by the way. You see it. I've seen it. And there they go into business. They get a vision that the Zion is going to be built. The Lord's going to come back, and that's where the temple's going to be rebuilt and be Zion. By the way, he got three visions. He kept having to leave, so they get new visions. The Mormons eventually had three visions, or Joe Smith did, three visions of where Zion was going to be. Kirtland, Ohio, Independence, Missouri, and Commerce, Missouri, which is now called Nauvoo. They changed the name to Nauvoo. Well, anyway, they set up shop in Kirtland, and there they began to set forth some of their doctrines. By the way, as I said last week, when they had their services, there was a Pentecostal movement. When they got together, they spoke in tongues and prophesied and did all that. That was the kind of church it was. Now Joe sees that he's a little too close to civilization. And so he and some others go out to Missouri, and they stake out some property, Independence, Missouri, because they know they're going to have to move. And he informs everybody, by the way, in case you didn't know this, that's where the original Garden of Eden was. You ever been to Independence, Missouri? It sure changed a lot. And by the way, during this period, Smith in 1832, Smith and Rigdon, as they later tell it, go on a celestial journey. They convert all the universe, visit all these planets, have a great time. And they also get, during the same period when they're being transported all the universe and seeing all of God's creation, they get tired and feathered and hired in Portage County for philandering with the wrong woman and for cheating people. So they were getting tired and feathered on Earth, but celestially they are being whisked about the universe to visit various planets. In 1835, Smith bought the Chandra manuscript. Now, the Chandra manuscript, let me say a word about that. And this was mentioned in the movie, very important evidence. Remember, you asked the question, what happened to the golden plates? You can't check them. The angel took them away. When in 1835, a man came, kind of a sideshow, a man called Chandra, who had bought some mummies and some Egyptian manuscripts. This was before the age of archaeology, been looted from the tombs. He was simply charging people to see them. In other words, and he, will you give me another extra time tonight when we finish this? I'll tell you at 9 o'clock. We got a late start tonight. But what happened was, briefly, this is very important, that he was traveling around, and then people would pay money, go into the behind the curtain, see these mummies and these manuscripts. These Egyptian, they were from Egyptian tombs. And they were just roughly just looted. We know now they came just looted before the time of Christ. They were buried, not they were the later period. Anyway, part of the Chandra spiel was, this is Egyptian writing and nobody can translate it. Now that was basically true. The Rosetta Stone had been found, but that the knowledge of it, the use of it, had not spread very far. So for all practical purposes, the Egyptian language could not be translated. But when he came near Kirtland, Ohio and said that, they said, oh yes, it can. We got a fellow up here who's translated the whole book of Egyptian writing. So they brought Joseph Smith the manuscripts and the mummies, and he immediately, he tried to connect Bible people with Egypt. What two Bible people get connected with Egypt in the Old Testament ancient period? Joseph and Abraham. He said one was written by Joseph, one was written by Abraham. And he translated the book of Abraham, translated it, and it's called the book of Abraham. It is the basis of the Mormon doctrine on race. It is the document that condemns the black race as being a cursed race. And it's a part, remember the Mormon trilogy? It's a part of the Pearl of Great Price. Well, when Joseph died and the church split, the family got the manuscripts. And they ended up in a museum in Chicago, and then in a museum in New York. The Mormons said for years that wasn't it too bad that the Mormon, that now that later when people could read hieroglyphics, by the way, the language of the Golden Plate was supposed to be Reformed Egyptian. There wasn't any such thing as Reformed Egyptian anyway. Now that we can read the Egyptian, ancient Egyptian language, they said, too bad we lost those manuscripts. But they were burned up in the Chicago fire. Matter of fact, they weren't. And every once in a while, people in the museum in New York would say, guess what? So we got your manuscripts. The good news, they weren't burned up. And the Mormons were the least good interest. Finally, the museum did the worst thing they could possibly, 1967, perfectly good faith, they did the worst thing they could ever do to the Mormons. They gave them the manuscripts. Of course, what they were garden variety funeral prayers that appear in all kinds of, the standard funeral prayers. It had nothing whatever to do with the way Joseph Smith translated it. Well, the Mormons said the enemies of God didn't translate it, and they were going to have their own man, old people translate it. So they got their top Egyptologist, a man called D.J. Nelson, J.A.Y. Nelson. He was a leading Egyptologist of the Mormon Church. He translated it, because he translated the same way everybody else did. And they kicked him out of the church. They promised about 10 years ago they were going to publish a report, an official statement, and they have not said a word about it since. Well, that's the significance of the Chandra manuscript, that particular manuscript. But it's not in heaven. They got it, and they, by the way, they don't tell the common Mormons about this, the lower level Mormons. I gave a series of lectures about 3 or 4 years ago in Southeast, and a young couple came who had been 14 years in Mormonism. He'd been well up in the priesthood. And they came out of it because they came out of it, a real nice family. They came out of it because Mormonism was destroying their family. They just walked away from it. And I told the story of the Chandra manuscript, but I just gave it to you. After the meeting, I said, we were talking, I said to them, did you all know about the Chandra manuscript? And she said, oh no, we've never heard of it. And he said, looking at his wife, I knew about it. She didn't know that he knew about it until he said, yeah, baby. We were aware of it. college. But she never heard of them. Of course, she's just a woman.
Amen.
Amen. There's a man here without his wife. His wife is going to hear about it. Well, anyway, the Mormons had to leave Cortland, Ohio, just very briefly now, in 1838, mainly because they set up a bank, took everybody's money, drained the funds away, and the bank failed. And the government was after them for bank fraud, issued fraudulent bank notes, and so they, of course, in Roman history, this is persecution. And they went to Commerce, Missouri, changed the name, got another vision of this week's symbol is going to be, changed their name to Nauvoo. By the way, Nauvoo is being restored today. You can see it. It's more something of a Mormon center and shrine. Now, here, Smith joins the Masons and steals their ritual. By the way, in Utah, I've been told that no Mormon was ever accepted in the Masons. Why? Because you see, the so-called secret ritual of the Masons, some of the liturgy and their symbols, Joseph Smith went to the Masons, he liked what he saw, he just took a lot of it wholesale. Much of it's not even changed. And so the so-called secret ritual of the Masons, which never was secret, by the way, you know, you go to the library and read it, but it was, I'm not a bad mouthing the Masons, I'm simply saying that ritual was not secret. But anyway, Joseph Smith just took it. As the film said, remember the film said this, Mason's life rituals, that's where he got them. Also during this, Joe is sleeping with every woman who will let him. And so he cooks up the doctrine of, he originally called it spiritual wifery. Spiritual wifery, can't say it. One of the changes. And to justify theologically what he was doing after dark, during the day, by the way, during this period, he lost Sidney Rigdon and tried to seduce Sidney's daughter. Now, Sidney was a seducer, too, but he wanted his own daughter seduced. So Sidney went back east. And by the way, Kirtland, Ohio, Brigham Young joined him, became Joe's right-hand man. So it was Sidney Rigdon, Brigham Young, and Joseph Smith, the three biggies, and then the Council of 12, and they formed the organization. Well, so polygamy begins about this period. By the way, they were forced out of Nauvoo, and they had trouble in originally they went to Missouri before they got to Nauvoo. The problem in Missouri was that they were too far. Remember, they left Kirtland because they were too close to civilization, too much law. They got to Missouri and they were too far away from it. What they would do, you see, by the way, when they went to Illinois, Nauvoo, Illinois, what I'm talking about happened to Illinois and Missouri right there on the border. Chicago was the biggest city in Illinois, I think about 300 people, 300 to 800 people. What the Mormons did, they said when they moved their hundreds into an area, they immediately became the voting majority. What they would do is simply elect their own judges, and then the Mormons would take the non-Mormons to court over property disputes. And the way they drew up property lines in those days, indeed, was very hit and miss. And of course, the Mormon judge would give the land to the Mormons. And those people, those frontiersmen, they solved their problems with a shotgun. They simply got together and started shooting. And a lot of bad, but evil was done on both sides. The Mormons and the war was fought, really. And the Mormons weren't the only ones who did what was wrong in those days. anyway, that's what happened. Eventually, Joseph seduced too many people, and some of the leaders got a printing press and started to expose some of his philanderings, his sexual philanderings. And he had formed a military or paramilitary group called the Danites, or the Avenging Angels, who were responsible for massacring a wagon train later on, the days of Brigham Young, called the Mountain Meadows Massacre. These were the enforcers later on, Brigham Young did them. But anyway, the Danites burnt the press and run these men out of town because they were going to publish this paper exposing Joseph Smith. Well, one of them, found him foster, the doctor, he went to the governor, went to Carthage, Missouri, and contacted the governor and swore out a warrant. And the state militia, and there were plenty of Missourians and Illinois ready to serve in the militia to go get the Mormons, came after Joe Smith, and he originally ran away, hid, and his wife told him to give himself up, and he did, and a mob stormed the somebody smuggled a revolver, revolvers into the fellow. There were three in jail, two with Joe Smith, small number. And they smuggled some guns into him. And a mob stormed the jail, and Joseph Smith gave his life to the Lord as soon as he ran out of ammunition. And that was, he was martyred and shed his blood for the few days. Well, the church then, to make a long story short, and we'll quickly pass, the church then divided. You see, Sidney Rigdon figured the church should have been his all along. As soon as he heard that Joe was dead, he beat it back from the East. Sidney Rigdon had been on a mission in the East. But he was out of town when this happened. I'm sorry, Brigham Young. So Sidney Rigdon was in the East because his, Smith had seduced his daughter. He got mad and left. Brigham Young was in the East on a mission. They both hightailed it back to Missouri and Nauvoo, and the border there too, to claim the church. Sidney Rigdon arrived first and simply declared himself the head of the church because it was his from the beginning anyway. Brigham Young, more diplomatic, he came along later and said, well, the Council of the Twelve should decide. And they liked that, so they chose him. Sidney Rigdon left town and got mad, gave up, and went back east and joined the Methodist Church. Died a Methodist. Well, the church, they couldn't, but there, you see, Brigham Young, who was a very charismatic leader, he ended up with the biggest follower. Most of them followed him. However, Joseph Smith's family, Joseph Smith Jr. was fairly young, his family did not follow Brigham Young. So the church divided. The larger group went into Nebraska and ended up in Salt Lake. They were called the Brighamites. And these are the major group. The other group, who are called the Josephites, who were called, you know, who followed Joseph Smith Jr., they stayed in Independence, Missouri, and are now known as the Reorganized Church of Latter-day Saints. Josephites, Brighamites. Now, there was a couple of three smaller splinter groups. One little group went up into Wisconsin. We don't have time to talk about them. There was one little group, by some strange quirk, ended up with the deed to the temple lot. When I was a little boy, growing up, the choir program every Sunday morning put on the temple lot monitor. You hear the temple lot monitor. They don't have much of a church, but they got the temple lot. They're, and the Salt Lake City Mormons have offered them millions for it. They won't take it. But when the Lord comes back, they got the temple. And by the way, it's not very big. I'm not very in this room. It's not a huge piece of property. They're small. So the Temple Lot Mormons were a small group, and they splintered. And since they have gone to the Reorganized Church of Latter-day Saints, do not practice polygamy, and never did, as they say they didn't, and they say that Joseph Smith never commanded it. Now, since the Salt Lake, and you got the film sort of gave you a profile of what the Salt Lake Mormons are. This film was on the Salt Lake Mormons, the Brighamites. Now, as they suggested, they are divided between, so there is the major group, which is dominated by Salt Lake, but there are many, many little cliques, little sects, fundamentalist groups who still practice polygamy and practice the older form of Mormonism. Well, between what I have given you, I had some other things I wanted to show you, but our time is up. I think you sort of, between what I have given you and the film, you sort of have a pretty good general picture of what you're doing. Thank you for your attention.